We're going to pick it up in Genesis chapter 43. So if you would, go ahead and open up your Bible to Genesis chapter 43. As we pick up our study, as we're getting through the last part of the book of Genesis here and the story of Joseph, trying to get everything in, but I was pleased to learn that I have one additional week that I didn't know I had. So that gave me just a little bit more cushion to make sure that we cover everything that I hope we can cover in the life of Joseph. If you've been with us as we've been studying Joseph, you've noted that everything that we've studied so far has really been looking towards the fulfillment of the dream or dreams that Joseph had right when we began looking at this account. In Genesis chapter 37, we read about the dreams that he had, and as unlikely as they seemed at that time, Jacob even kind of reprimanded Joseph for saying these things. We're going to see their fulfillment in the chapters we're going to be getting into tonight. Last week, if you were here, we looked at Genesis chapter 42, and Joseph's brothers finally are coming before Joseph without Benjamin. And as you may recall, they did kneel before him, but things did not go exactly as planned in that they were some extra money was planted on them, and they had to leave Simeon behind, kind of as a ransom, so that they would come back and bring Benjamin at some point. And so we ended by kind of looking at Jacob's response to the situation, and Jacob was not exactly showing a lot of faith at the end of that chapter. And so we're going to pick it up here in Genesis chapter 43 here tonight. Before we do get into the text, I want to ask this question. How many of you here tonight would love to work on one of those? If you can't see what it is, this might be a clear picture. Oh, I think I took it out. How many of you love jigsaw puzzles? Okay, there's one hand over there. You're one of those. I mean, you get a 1,000-piece puzzle and it's laid out. Okay, I'm not one of those people. I'm not one of those people. You can put the box up and everything else, and I stare at it, and I don't get the same enjoyment out of it that some of you do. However, what makes it a little bit easier is you put the box up so you kind of have an idea what the picture looks like. If you don't know what the picture looks like, that puzzle is pretty confusing. You don't know where to go. You don't know where the pieces are. You could do some parts, but the middle gets to be kind of difficult. And, you know, as we go through this study of the life of Joseph and really his brothers, we're kind of reminded of how life is a puzzle, that there may be things that are happening that at the time sure don't seem very good. These brothers have had some things happen that don't seem very good. Joseph has had some things happen that don't seem very good. Now, if they see the big picture of where this is going, which is really Joseph's dreams, it's all going towards that fulfillment. But they don't know that. We think Joseph has the faith. I've showed you this picture before, but don't you wish sometimes you could say, you know, dear younger me, you're wrong. Love older, wiser me. Sometimes as we get older, we have a greater appreciation for the big picture of what we see in God's Word because we've experienced some of these ups and downs in life, and we realize that there's something bigger than us that's involved. So let's take a look at Genesis 43, because that roller coaster for Joseph's brothers is going to continue here in the text in Genesis chapter 43. So let's read the first 10 verses of chapter 43. Dad, you have that? You want to read those verses for me?
Yes.
All right, so let me first ask this question. Where in these verses do you read the concern that either Jacob or the brothers have for Simeon? What verse? You don't read it, do you? You don't. And here's Simeon still there in Egypt, and you don't read any reference. Jacob doesn't bring it up. The brothers here don't reference it in the same way, although they mention that they need to bring Benjamin. But they don't seem to express a whole lot of concern for Simeon, which I think is interesting. So the famine's still going on, and I want you to notice what Jacob says. You know, here they are. They've gone through all their grain, which should be a pretty major issue. I mean, they're going to starve. They need to have the food. How much food does Jacob say they should go get in verse 2? Why don't you go and just go get a little food? Why do you think it even says that? A little food. I mean, obviously that they need more than a little food. Just go get a little food. I mean, they got a lot of people to feed. What do you think?
Maybe that's all they expect to be allowed to buy.
It could be. And I may be speculating here, but I think we're going to see evidence in a minute that I think Jacob is avoiding any possibility that Benjamin has to get involved here. Maybe you can just go get a little bit of food. And maybe if you get a little bit of food, this issue won't come up. But Judah's not going to have it. He's not going to let this go by without reminding Jacob of what happened. And he kind of confronts his father with reality. And he twice tells him that the man, who we know as Joseph, warned them that they could not come back unless they brought their younger brother. And so Judah kind of gives him this reality check. And in verses 3 through 6, it seems like Jacob still isn't willing to make the hard decision. In fact, what does it look like he's doing in those verses? If you read what he says, what's it sound like to you? It's your fault. Why did you bring this trouble on me by telling the man that you had one more brother? It's your fault. So I want you to think about what he's doing. He's blaming the brothers. He's pretty much rebuking them for telling the truth. He's kind of saying, I'm the victim here. If you'd been more careful, this might not have happened. And so by complaining to his son, really, again, he's rebuking them for telling the truth. Now, Jacob's kind of living up to his nickname of what he's done in the past, and that was being a deceiver. I mean, that's what we've seen him do in the past. On the other hand, I want you to think about Judah. Judah is taking the lead. Now, we saw Reuben talk in the last chapter. Reuben's the oldest, but here we see Judah taking the lead. And this is kind of the beginning of a turnaround that we're going to see with Judah. And Judah's pretty forthright. This is an amazing part of this chapter and this whole study. If you think about Judah's background, if you haven't been here, just a little bit about this guy. This is the same guy that proposed the sale of Joseph to the Midianites in the first place. This is the same brother who had separated himself from his family and was living with the Canaanites. This is the same brother who was hanging around with an ungodly man named Hira. This is the same guy who married an unbeliever in chapter 38 and verse 2. It was Judah, who obviously was not a spiritual leader. In fact, his sons were so sinful that they were basically killed by God. And then we all know the story that we read earlier where Judah was also sexually immoral. He slept with a supposed prostitute who he later found out was his daughter-in-law. This is the Judah that we saw before. Now we're starting to see a change. Look at what we see in chapter 43. In chapter 43, he seems to be a different man. He urges his father to stop thinking of himself and to act in the best interest of the entire family. Think about what was said here. Think about all the if we go back, we're not going to see Simeon again. Jacob seems to be spoken, you know, me, I, me, my, whereas Judah, in everything he says, seems to be talking about we, us, and our. And so it's an interesting change as we see Judah, who seems to have really changed his heart. I don't know if it was the situation with Tamar, where he discovered that he was the one who'd done these things that did it, but he sure seems to be a different person than we saw before. Any questions or comments in those first 10 verses of chapter 43? Chris? When you've been humbled in the way that they were, especially during a time of physical need, it changes. It changed their whole attitude. Absolutely. Thank you. A little warm in here, so we're going to try to. I'm assuming that's why you did that. All right, let's go. Let's look at the next few verses. Let's read verses 11 to 15. Let's see here. Ed, do you mind reading that for me? Do you have that?
And the father of Israel said unto them, if it must be so now, do this, take of the best fruits of the land in your vessels, and carry down the commandment be present, the old ball and the old money, slices of myrrh, dust and aloes. And take the old money in your hand, and the money that was brought again in the vessel. Your sacks, carry it again in your hand. Readventure it was an oversight. Take also your brother and your right.
So as we see this section, we look at Jacob. We talked about his lack of faith before. Do you see his faith increasing here at all? Does this look like a place where Jacob's standing up and showing faith? What do you think? Verse 11, then their father Israel said to them, well, if it must be so, then do this. Kind of sounds like resignation to me, like, all right, if there's nothing else, then fine. Take some of the best products and let's take all this stuff. And at the end of the day, Jacob has a tradition. And the tradition is, when he's got a disagreement with someone, what does he do? Let me see if I can give them a bunch of stuff. Isn't that what he did in the meeting with Esau back in chapter 32 and 33? Remember that? Let me just send a bunch of gifts and stuff, and maybe that is what will happen here. So what we're going to do here is we're going to take the best, and in verse 12, we're going to double it. I mean, we're going to make sure, so that they're going to make sure that it's anything that was taken is returned. Take your brothers. It's interesting, though, but even in verse 14, he says, as for me, if I lose my children, I lose them. It's just, again, kind of like this idea of, I don't get a lot of faithfulness here in this response. Now, if you think about what he may be worried about, let's now jump back to Jacob's side. What would his concerns be about them going back? Losing his sons and probably protecting Benjamin is number one. Number two, how did you get this extra money? You mean you got this extra money and you're just bringing it back? I mean, this is going to be a weird story, isn't it? We're coming to buy food, and by the way, when we left, we found this extra money in our sacks. We don't know how it got there. Here it is. This is going to be kind of weird, isn't it? Jacob knows that. Is it really going to have Simeon released? Or is this just going to cause more problems? Jacob doesn't seem to have a whole lot of faith. Now, when we look at Benjamin here, he is about 16 years younger than Joseph, so probably about 23, 24. Joseph was probably about 39, based on the ages that we see referenced in later passages. You know, when we look at Jacob, someone came up with this, and I thought it was interesting. Oh, I lost it. Let's see here. Kayla, you up there?
Yeah.
Somehow I lost the... There we go. Jacob's, I'll call it, lack of leadership principles. What does he do? Whatever problems arise today are best dealt with tomorrow. I mean, Simeon's been sitting here all this time, and he hasn't done anything about it. But we'll get to that one. When we run out of food, maybe then we'll do something. Jim? My understanding is the journey, and I recall it was about 250, 300 miles, so it's about a six-week period to go there and back. So this is a long journey. That's my understanding of estimates. No problem can possibly be as bad as it seems. Honesty is not the best policy. Always look out for number one at the end of the day. As much as is possible, see to it that others receive the blame for any problems. Sons, it's your fault. You shouldn't have said anything. And finally, if our efforts to solve a problem fail, add money. And maybe then it'll work out. And then last but not least, when all else fails, well, then you can trust God. And that almost seems like what's happening here with Jacob is finally at the end, there's kind of some resignation, but it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of faith. Any comments on that section before we read the next part? Yeah, they're out of there. They don't have any grain, but yet they're taking these items that seem to be food-type items. It's also ironic, and I think if we go back to 37, I think some of these gifts are similar to, especially the silver, to what they received when Joseph was sold. And so now we see it going back in a whole different way. It is kind of odd. Pay attention to Joseph's reaction to these gifts later. Is Joseph going to really care about these gifts? We'll see that he really doesn't. Let's take a look at the next few sections, few verses here. Let's look at verses 16 to 23. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the servant who was over his household, "Bring the men to the house, slaughter an animal, and prepare it, for the men will eat with me at noon." The man did just as Joseph said. He brought the men into Joseph's house. But the men were afraid when they were brought to Joseph's house. They said, "We are being brought in because the money that was returned in our sacks last time. He wants to capture us, make us slaves, and take our donkeys." You can understand why they felt that way. I mean, this is an odd situation. Now they're going to his house. Something about it doesn't seem right. So they approached they approached the man who was in charge of Joseph's household and spoke to them at the entrance of the house. They said, "My lord, we did indeed come down the first time to buy food. But when we came to the place where we spent the night, we opened our sacks and each of us found his money, the full amount, in the mouth of a sack. So we have returned it. We have brought additional money with us to buy food. We do not know who put the money in our sacks." Now, if I'm the brothers and I just tell the story of, you know, I mean, can you imagine the other side, how this sounds? The money kind of just ended up in our sacks. We really don't know how. I'm sure they're standing back thinking, okay, what's going to happen now? Just arrest me now or put me in the prison now. And what is the response in the next verse? "Everything is fine." The man in charge of Joseph's household told them, "Don't be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. Then he brought Simeon out to them. This is totally not what they expected. Instead of expecting punishment, instead of expecting prison or something for what they did, they're basically told, don't worry about it. Everything, this was, it was a gift for you. And on top of that, the brother that you're wanting, here he is. I mean, this is going better than they could have possibly expected. Let's look at verse 24. The servant in charge brought the men into Joseph's house. He gave them water, and they washed their feet. Then he gave food to their donkeys. They got their gifts ready for Joseph's arrival at noon, for they had heard that they were to have a meal there. When Joseph came home, they presented him with the gifts they had brought inside, and they bowed down to the ground before him. Again, promise fulfilled. Brothers have bowed down before him for now the second time, although now they're all there. He asked them how they were doing. Then he said, is your aging father well? The one you spoke about. Is he still alive? Your servant, our father, is well, they replied. He's still alive. They bowed down in humility. When Joseph looked up and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, he said, is this your youngest brother whom you told me about? Then he said, may God be gracious to you, my son. Joseph hurried out, for he was overcome by affection for his brother and was at the point of tears. So he went to his room and wept there. Then he washed his face and came out, and with composure, he said, set out the food. This is yet another occasion where we see Joseph showing just the emotion that he was holding in during this account, and just seeing his younger brother, the younger brother that it was of the same mother that he was, maybe looked somewhat the same, we don't know, but just overcome with emotion. In verse 32, it says, they set a place for him and a separate place for his brothers and another for the Egyptians who were eating with him. The Egyptians are not able to eat with the Hebrews, for the Egyptians think it is disgusting to do so. Understand that the Egyptians and the Hebrews ate very different food, and literally disgusting is how they felt. They did not get near. So that was, Hebrews ate food that Egyptians thought as sacred. In verse 33, they sat before him arranged by order of birth, beginning with the firstborn, ending with the youngest. The men looked at each other in astonishment. Again, I can imagine just the looks on their faces. What are the chances that this, you know, I can imagine, okay, a brother and a sister, one or two or three, but to have this many brothers arranged in order, what are the chances of that happening? I mean, the astonishment on their face. I wish I could see what they looked like. In verse 34, it says, he gave them portions of the food set before him, but the portion for Benjamin was five times greater than the portions for any of the others. They drank with Joseph until they all became drunk. Now, in this last verse, it was an honor to get a double portion, but to get five portions was quite an honor. Why do you think Joseph did this? Besides the fact that he hasn't seen his youngest brother, but to give five times to Benjamin. You think he had any other motives for doing this?
I think he's playing with them. The thing with seating them in order had to get them wondering, does he know something? And then for him to treat Benjamin like that's almost like another clue.
Yeah, it's almost like another clue, and you, again, it's the favorite brother in a way, and he might have been wondering, what are they going to do? Here's Benjamin, the favorite of the favorite mother, and guess what? He gets five portions. Maybe he wanted to see, what are they going to say? What are they going to do? Are they going to say something about this? I don't know. I tend to think it might have been part of the scheme to really test his brothers. It's kind of ironic that Joseph is hosting a meal for his brothers who years before were eating Well, he was in a pit pleading to get out. But now he's hosting a brother, hosting a meal for all of them. Any comments or questions on this chapter before we move into the next chapter? One of the things that you'll notice throughout this chapter and what we see throughout this entire study is the attitude of Joseph's brothers changing. And so you see that the brothers that we knew in the prior chapters, you're going to see difference. We already saw that with Judah. And I think that the author's goal, Moses, inspired by God, is to show that God's design for Israel's fathers are working toward the end result, which is redeeming the household of faith, fulfilling the promises that have been here since we've been reading in Genesis chapter 12. Everything is leading towards that. And even though we have these men that didn't exactly act in a way that suggested that they deserved any of this, God is working through them anyway. So let's move ahead to Genesis chapter 44. So Genesis chapter 44, you're coming out of a time when things are really good. Things are really, really good. Here they are experiencing this meal. They got their brother back. Nothing's happening for the money that was in their sacks. Things are good. Reminds me of a story that I think illustrates what we're going to do next. There was four college sophomores that were taking a chemistry class. They were all good students, they were good friends, and they lived together in off-campus housing. Unfortunately, the night before the exam, rather than studying, they stayed out late partying. And they overslept the next morning, and they missed their final exam. Later that day, they found their professor, and they told him that they'd gotten a flat tire. And they didn't have a spare. As a result, they missed the final. So they begged him, "Can we please take the final the next day?" The professor thought it over and agreed. The guys were elated. They were relieved. They studied that night. And the next day they came in and the professor was there with the exams just as he had told them. He placed them in separate rooms. He handed each one of them a test booklet and told them to begin. The first problem was worth 5 points. It was an easy question about chemical elements. And they all thought about it at the same time. Yeah. This is going to be easy. Each one finished the problem and they turned the page. On the second page was written a second problem worth 95 points. And the question was simply this: which tire? They're all in separate rooms. I think in many ways, that's what we're seeing set up for us in Genesis chapter 44. These guys think, hey, we're okay. Everything's going to be okay. Joseph is about to give them a test to see how they're going to do and see how will they handle this situation. Some people might call this truth and consequences. So it ends chapter 43. They're happy. They hadn't been arrested. Simeon was released. They're the honored guest. They're getting ready to go home with sacks full of grain. Sounds pretty good to me. Let's read the first 6 verses. John Bradford, you want to read that for me?
44, 1 through 6?
Yes.
"And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they could carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also, put my silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his money." So he did, according to the word Joseph had spoken. As soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, they and
Okay, so the brothers are leaving, and they have to be pretty happy as they leave. But they're leaving, but there's still some unresolved issues. Earlier, when things were going bad, they were even confessing that maybe some of these things are happening because of what we did to our brother all those years ago. There's still some guilt deep down. Isaiah chapter 32 and verse 17 says, "And the work of righteousness will be peace, and the service of righteousness, quietness and confidence forever." You may have happiness, but you're never going to have true peace unless you deal with those sins that are in your life and get past them and have true forgiveness for them. They don't have that here, and they're going to have a big surprise come up here in just a minute. So Joseph has this little plan, and the plan is, I'm going to get this cup, the silver cup, and put it in the mouth of Benjamin's sack and have my servant go catch up with them and catch them as if they're stealing this. And so they get ready to do that. Now, let me stop for just a minute, because there's an issue that sometimes comes up in these verses that people have different ideas about, and that is in verse 5. In verse 5 it says, "Doesn't my master drink from this cup and use it for divination?" My question is, what is divination? Joseph has this cup and he uses it for divination. What is that? Pardon me? Like fortune telling? Is that what you said? Yeah, foretelling. What? Joseph is like fortune telling? Later in the chapter, we're going to get to this in a minute, in verse 15, Joseph, in talking to his brother, says, "Don't you know that a man like me can find out things like this by divination?" So what is divination? Well, divination is to uncover hidden knowledge by supernatural means. Now, we knew that Joseph could interpret dreams, but to have a cup and say somehow this cup was used for divination... What we know in the Bible is fortune-telling or soothsaying is another word for it. Later in Scripture, divination is strictly forbidden. When the law is written, they're very strict about this in Scripture, that it's something that you cannot do. It's listed as one of the reasons that the nation of Israel was later exiled, is divination. So the question is, what is Joseph doing with divination? This is something that I can understand the Egyptians doing, but is Joseph involved in this? Some people have brought this up and suggested that somehow that this is some kind of a contradiction. I don't think it is. It's not that big a deal. This is what I think the answer is. If anybody ever brings this up, this is the best I could come up with for it. He used this divining cup, I think, as just part of a test for his brothers. Well, I don't know that I know the exact difference, but I think divination was specifically where you were fortune-telling or because of an idol or because of, in this case, a cup, that somehow with that you could tell the future. And it wasn't any more than that, whereas witchcraft, you know, believed they could do other things as well. But I think sometimes there was an overlap between the two. A lot of witches thought they could do that. Mike? Yeah, I mean, we knew he could interpret dreams. I mean, he probably knew their birth order. Is there a hand back here, too? Shane? quite a roller coaster, we'll say that. John?
Well, it's the series that scares. He says it's silver cup, which some sort of chalice, whatever the ruler had, is the significance of the ruler at the time. The divination is brought by the one who finds it, the guard, whoever it is, who finds it in the pouch. He has instructed to say that would probably make them squirm even more, that this guy.
Right.
Now we're definitely in trouble, right? So,
right.
I think it's just words used still to lay some heaviness on the point.
Right.
I don't think it's, and divination would be more consulting with the gods, and they are in Egypt.
Absolutely.
So.
Okay. Devin, did you have something like that to say, or did you cover it? Okay. So, I think that's right. I think at the end of the day, you nailed it. It was part of the test. It was pretty common in the Middle East. In fact, it was mentioned earlier by Laban in Genesis 30 and verse 27. I think it was likely referenced as part of the test because in Egypt, when they mentioned divination cup, as John just said, the divination cup? This isn't just a silver cup. This is something that is of great value, probably would have been very common in Egypt. And so it wasn't necessarily, oh, this is something I'm doing. I think it was all part of his plan. He may have owned a divination cup, as did most Egyptian nobility, but I don't think it was any more than that. He was trying to show there was value. This wasn't just some cup. This was a big deal. So let's see their reaction, and let's read verses 7 through 13. Scott, you mind reading that for me? Yeah. 7 through 13. So the brothers, I mean, they're here like, hey, first of all, they're a little shocked. Why would you even say these things? In fact, why would we bring money back to you if we were thieves? That's their first argument. Why would we do that? What kind of men would do that? That doesn't make any sense. In fact, they're so strong in saying it, they say, if any one of us has it, we'll not only become a slave, that person will die. Okay. Based on the track record of what's happened so far, does that seem like a smart thing to say? it kind of reminds us a little bit earlier when Laban had searched Jacob's things looking for the household idols that Rachel took. Do you remember that? Jacob had rashly pronounced a death sentence on the guilty person, not knowing that it was Rachel who had actually taken it. In this case, we've got this death sentence that's pronounced, and the servant says, well, you suggested no punishment. Thankfully, they didn't go with the death sentence. They say that whoever's caught will be the slave. And you have to think it kind of heightens the tension. How did they do the search? What order? Oldest to youngest. So we're slowly going through the sacks until finally we get to Benjamin. There it is, the very last one. And you see their reaction here. They tear their clothes, which is the kind of thing that would happen when somebody's grieving. And it says there at the very end that they tore their clothes and then they loaded their donkey and they returned to the city. I have to wonder, as we look at this, because our time is about up, just what kind of questions these brothers might have been asking each other or thinking about. How could they prove their innocence? I mean, there it is. It was in Benjamin's sack. Would Benjamin be a slave or would he be killed? I suggested he'd be killed. What's going to happen now? Did Benjamin really do it? You have to wonder if maybe that went through their minds, because there it was in a sack. Why did we make such a foolish offer? Why did we say that? You have to think that they were thinking that. What would Judah say to his father Jacob when he finds out that here we think we're coming back with everybody, and your youngest son, the one you were so concerned about, is the one that is going to be left behind? What are we going to say? Or are we all going to be condemned as thieves when we go back? Mike, is your hand up? Sure seems like it, huh? Yeah, and they're probably just, I mean, what they're feeling at this point, I think we're going to see some of it from the things that they say. I think the bell's going to ring in just a minute here, but I'll just ask you this question before we end. What is the longest recorded speech by any man in the book of Genesis? What do you think? That's your question, your quiz question for the night. The longest recorded speech by any man in the book of Genesis. Yeah, you can think if I'm asking it now, it must have something to do with where we're at. The speech of Judah that we're about to read is the longest speech in all of Genesis. Isn't that interesting? The guy who had done all these things, and it's a beautiful speech. We'll pick it up there.